From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A response appears to be developing from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to the newly aggressive posture of the United States towards those three. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Nicaragua on Monday. Well, we may have Pompeo and the Three Stooges of foreign policy, Pompeo and Bolton and...
Abrams.
Yeah, Abrams. We may have them on the job, but they're not the only ones, and they're not driving the bus, as it might appear if you're looking only at the U.S. media. Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, reaching into Brazil and across the region. There's a counteroffensive that's being assembled here, and it's kind of interesting to watch this.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I think you're right to say that there is a counteroffensive, but and I think there's something else going on, which is something that we talked about in our previous two conversations, namely that the United States does not have anything resembling a coherent foreign policy in Latin America.
Right.
And so what they bet on was that the gains that they made by promoting a usurper government in Brazil, by wangling a deceitful crook like Mauricio Macri into power in Argentina, by ensuring that the left in Chile remained divided so that Piñera could get in, the right wing Sebastian Piñera could get in Chile, and so on. They bet on their machinations being able to give them sufficient momentum to be able to bully their way into imposing what they wanted in Venezuela and Nicaragua. And now we can see with the activation of the Title III section of the Helms-Burton Act,
Cuba,
they still believe that. They still think that if they bully enough and if they intimidate enough, that they'll get their way. Mm. But that isn't a foreign policy.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm obviously putting things in a very crude way, but essentially that is the reality. And so what you then have to do is juxtapose that reality with the efforts by other countries to defend international law and also promote their own interests. So and what happened recently with the Belt and Road Initiative summit that was led by President Xi Jinping was that is now an undeniable reality that the United States can do nothing about.
Right.
And all they can do is try and sabotage it here and there. And what are you talking about? You're talking about huge amounts of money. What was it? What was the sum that was thrown around at the recent summit?
About Cuba?
No, $640 billion, the Belt and Road Initiative.
Right.
And it was like $640 billion in Chinese investment. And so and this brings up another thing that we were talking about in recent conversation, namely the dilemma for the right-wing elites that you'd expect to be natural U.S. allies, and but they see that their interests are primarily in developing their relationship with China,
right?
And certainly their economic and commercial interests, and so you have that, and. So what's the United States trying to do? It's in Venezuela and in Nicaragua, it's trying to use its proxies to intimidate whole peoples. In Nicaragua's case and in Venezuela's case, the great majority of people in the country support their government. and either actively or in the sense that they certainly don't want the opposition.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely categorically true, both in Venezuela and in Nicaragua.
And it's been true in Cuba for 60 years now. I mean, sure. You know, they had we've had sanctions applied to Cuba even before Castro and the revolution. Actually, in January 1st of 59. Back in 58, they imposed an arms embargo in the waning days of Batista. But starting in 1961, they passed the kinds of sanctions we're looking at now that came into effect in February of 62. So we're talking 57 years ago, and then some, and just tighter and tighter, hoping that the people would, you know, by starving or suffering without, rise up against their government and make some kind of a deal with the United States. And that hasn't happened. And then they were caught off guard flat-footed when they tried the coup in Venezuela because the people came and rescued their president from this kind of a thing. So, and we saw what happened last year in Nicaragua as well. And as a matter of fact, we saw what happened in Nicaragua when you had the Contra War conducted against the revolution, and you had the period after that where the right wing was given power through the facade of an election. The people were just—they won't be repressed. They want their independence, and they want their sovereignty, and they want control over their fate.
Yeah, and so I think that's one of the absolute fundamentals that underlies the unraveling of U.S. what passes for U.S. foreign policy in Latin America.
Agreed.
And they cannot negate the undeniable will of the impoverished majority that they deserve a better life. And as you've pointed out various times, as we've both pointed out various times in our recent conversations, once people get a taste of liberty and emancipation, they're very unlikely to let it be taken away from them. And that's what the United States is trying to do. So that's one of the elements, this popular rejection of US policy in the region.
Yes.
And we're also likely to see that, of course, in Bolivia later this year, in the elections in Bolivia. And we're also likely to see it in Argentina with a wholesale rejection of the completely failed neoliberal policies of Mauricio Macri. But that's one element. Then, as I said before, the other element is the dilemma that the kind of facing the elites in the region between accepting U.S. hegemony that does very little in terms of their own economic welfare. It may protect their prestige and influence in the status quo, but it doesn't actually do anything to promote their economies, whereas China does, and with its win-win policy that we've talked about so many times.
Right.
So that's another element in the unraveling of U.S. Machinations in the region. And then you have the fact that country and that has been expressed, those two things that I just mentioned have very much been expressed, I think, in the election last year of Andrés Manuel López Obrador as president of Mexico. And that was, we'll look back on that in a couple of years, 2-3 years, and see that as a key element in what has led to the falling apart, the collapse of U.S. influence in the region and U.S. power and influence in the region. Of course, it still has power in the region, but nothing like it used to. Can you imagine some of the things that have happened in the recent past happening maybe 20 years ago,
right,
or 25 years ago? And it's just what Hugo Chavez and Néstor Kirchner in Argentina and Lula in Brazil and Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, and Evo Morales achieved in that block of time between, what was it? In Chavez's case, his endeavor started back in 1998-1999 in terms of effectively wielding power and changing policy. But the real nitty-gritty of change happened really between something like 2006 and 2012, something like that. certain, and the end of that period was definitely marked by the death of Hugo Chavez, yeah. The untimely tragic death, which many people think was a murder by the United States, yeah. of Hugo Chavez in March 2013. So what Mexico represents is a kind of recovery of Latin American dignity,
yeah.
In probably what is the second most important economy in the continent.
Yeah, and it's an interesting. It's not just a rebalancing back towards that. It's actually an affirmative gain because it's been a very, very long time since Mexico has been allowed to move in that direction, or where the internal forces were so strong that they just forced themselves in that direction despite the best efforts or the worst efforts of the United States.
Yeah, and if you look at, if you go country by country and look at the standing of the U.S. allies in each country, and they're not doing well at all. In Colombia, Iván Duque is still struggling to roll back the terms of the peace agreement that was signed by his predecessor, Juan Manuel Santos, with the former FARC guerrilla. And it's by no means, there was a crucial vote today. I haven't seen the outcome of the vote in, I think it was in the Colombian Senate on that. And the likelihood is that Duque lost, but we'll know later on. But the thing about that in Colombia, for example, there's a scandal now. And there are all kinds of scandals, and the large number of community leaders that have been murdered in the first 3 months of the year, the latest murder of a FARC, an ex-FARC fighter, by the Colombian army, that has led to calls for the resignation of the Minister of Defense, and that's the continuing scandalous death by hunger of children in parts of rural Colombia. And there's scandal after scandal rocking Colombia. And now, and over the weekend, there was serious street violence as a result of police trying to repress legitimate demonstrations. And the U.S. allies are themselves in crisis in the region. That's true in Argentina, where the economic crisis is deepening even more than it had done to date. And I don't think the right wing will ever recover from what they've done to Argentina over the last 4 years in electoral terms. Well, we'll see, won't we, later in the year. So Argentina's in crisis, Colombia's in crisis, Brazil's in crisis. And I don't know, I haven't read what Noam Chomsky's remarks, but I just saw a headline that he thinks that Lula will be out of jail in the next few months, and is likely to return to the presidency within a short period of time. Let's hope right. Chomsky's right. But I'd like to know on what he's basing that, because I think there's still, unfortunately, a period of 2 to 3 years that Brazil has to go through before they finally kind of work out the and get out of their political system the corruption and intellectual failure, economic failure, the moral failure of the right-wing government that they elected, thanks to Brazil's justice system sticking Lula da Silva in jail when he was obviously the favorite to win those presidential elections. So in Brazil, Argentina, in Colombia, you have this crisis. In Ecuador, Lenin Moreno's project to hand Ecuador back on a plate to U.S. imperialist interests, U.S. corporate interests, that too is falling apart in domestic, right. In terms of his domestic popular support. And in Peru, it's not clear that the current government, although it's managed to clean up its act in terms of the popular perception that the authorities are finally doing or have finally done something about corruption, it's not clear that progress in political terms for the right wing in Peru is going to be matched by the kind of economic performance that they that they enjoyed in over the last 5, 6, 7, or 8 years when Peru was one of the most successful economies in Latin America. So, and if you go country by country, you can see, and also Panama and Costa Rica and all these countries that have been supportive of the moves against Venezuela and the moves against Nicaragua, perhaps less supportive of the attack on Cuba, and not very active in the developing US moves against Bolivia. But in all these countries, you can see that United States allies are in crisis themselves. And that adds up to another component in the unraveling of U.S. machinations in Latin America and the Caribbean. So, and the perhaps the a symbolic instance of that is the fact that Venezuela has now completed its 2-year term that it had to wait following its initial decision notifying the Organization of American States that it would leave. It notified the Organization of American States of its decision to leave that body 2 years ago. Right. Now, on April 27th, the 2 years are up, and Venezuela is no longer a member of the OAS, like Cuba. Now, and some people would say, well, it's a shame that back when all the progressive governments in the region had the chance that they didn't leave the OAS en bloc. And you can argue about that. But whatever you think about that issue, the OAS is finished.
Yeah.
And as in terms of its credibility, it'll still kind of soldier on and go through the motions of being a kind of regional body with its Inter-American Human Rights Commission and whatnot. But it's in terms of its credibility, and especially in terms of the credibility of the complete odious clown that is Luis Almagro, the Secretary General. And I think he as an individual has done more than anything to render the OAS a pitiful laughingstock.
Right.
And at an international level. So and that too, the collapse in the credibility of the OAS, that is another sign of the unraveling of U.S. activities and policy, in such as it is, in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So then, and what does that all add up to? And it means that if you want to take a snapshot of Latin America now, whereas if you'd taken that snapshot a year ago, the apologists for what the right wing call a conservative restoration could have made a kind of plausible case that their political ideology was, you know, making a strong showing and was likely to prevail in the region for some time. Well, and it doesn't look like that now. If you take a snapshot now, they're all in crisis. And the governments that those countries have tried to overthrow using every illicit measure, using completely defying international law and every kind of norm of diplomatic and behavior and the way of implementing international relations, despite everything, Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua are still there, and their governments aren't going to go away, and it's the right wing governments that we will see over the next year will be the ones that are in crisis, and if they ever had any legitimacy, that legitimacy will very clearly have fallen away within the next what year, 18 months. And I don't think that it's in any way controversial to suggest that.
You know, if you look at the policies of these governments in contrast one to the other, the left against the right governments. As you know, and I'd say that the last 10 years of, you know, certainly the last 20 years, but the last 10 years have given an opportunity, you know, even under conditions of duress and assault and economic warfare and such, for the left to demonstrate, you know, the difference in its orientation and the implications of that for the populations against the right, which it had ample opportunity up to that point to demonstrate where it goes, having led all the way up through after, you know, 100, 200 years of super exploitation straight through the neoliberal economics that left the countries bankrupt and the people unemployed and in hock and in foreclosure, eviction and homelessness and everything else that came before the so-called pink tide came in. The conditions that existed from Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, all across the entire region that resulted in having Lula and Kirchner and Hugo Chavez and Correa and Morales. So you've had a chance for in the recent memories of people to see the expression, if not the fullest expression, of either trend. And so you have the right acting essentially as an agent of austerity, of looting, and of repression, and the left offering a policy of a million apartments or 2 million apartments of, you know, self-determination, dignity, you know, a variety of literacy and healthcare and all these different material benefits. People have seen this team A is offering us this, and this team B is offering us that. And to the extent that they're allowed to actually choose, you know, there's really a very strong case that's made, you know, in this, in the guts and the hearts and the minds of the people for the left. And so every game that's being implemented to thwart that gets played out, but this drive doesn't go away, because at the end of the day, after their side wins and delivers a right-wing government, now you're delivering hunger and poverty to a population that isn't going to just sit down and take it. And that's the contradiction that these people can't get past.
Yeah, and you can see that in the way that here in Nicaragua and in Venezuela, the opposition, it's absolutely clear that the opposition take their orders from the United States. And here in Nicaragua, the opposition, and in both countries, the opposition, the main thing preventing the opposition being effective is that they hate each other. They themselves hate each other.
We saw that in Venezuela, too, right? You have these different opposition leaders that can't sit in a room with each other. And
yeah, it would be comical if it weren't so tragic for the country, because what it means is that, and they, because they're unable to develop a coherent policy platform or agree on anything because they hate each other, and that means that there is no one to talk to. And so it's like, I remember back in the 1980s, and the Sandinista government used to say, when they were encouraged to sit down and talk to the Contra revolution funded by the United States, what's the point of talking to the organ grinder's monkey when the person we have to talk to is the organ grinder?
Right, that's right.
We're back, it's like we're reliving that now, both in Venezuela and in Nicaragua, where the opposition are supposedly in talks to reach an agreement about peace and understanding to bring stability, economic stability to the country, but for the past week or so, every day they're supposed to turn up to the site for the meetings and take part in the meetings, but for about 10 days they just haven't turned up. Today they turned up. But it's kind of, you never know when they're going to get up and walk away.
Right.
It's just, and it's, look it at is last pathetic. Year. And it's very clear. People in Nicaragua, even people who don't follow politics especially, are very clear that it's the United States that's telling them what to do and what they can agree to and what they can't agree to. And that, you know, that completely cuts away any credibility that the opposition may have here and strengthens the hand of the government, which has been insisting ever since the very first days of the failed attempted coup back in April of 2018, they've been insisting that they want a dialogue and they want to reach a solution that that will prevail and provide Nicaragua with the stability they enjoyed prior to April 2018. But the opposition are incapable of delivering it because that is not what the United States wants. So that's, you know, and that, but then the United States itself, as my colleague Jorge Capellan has pointed out, because the United States doesn't have a foreign policy in Latin America, and in this case, in particular in Central America, because it doesn't have a coherent foreign policy, there are sections of the U.S. authorities that recognize that letting Nicaragua fall apart would be extremely bad news for the United States in all kinds of ways. So that you have this total incoherence in United States policy in Latin America, and Nicaragua is just the latest example of it. And that means that the long-term prospects for United States authority and influence are not good. Right. People are just going to, you know, the United States will be like somebody addressing a public meeting and everybody just drifts away and leaves them alone talking to nobody.
Right, no time to go out for a cigarette. Yeah, right. Like you notice the room empties out, you know.
Right. And that is what it's going to be like. And I think that we're going to see that very clearly within the next 18 months.
Well, you know, if you look at last year's presidential election in Venezuela, for example, you know, the U.S. has been tightening the screws steady, you know, slowly and steadily, well, since 1998 or 1999, really, or certainly since 2002. But Obama really started focusing on that in earnest around the same time that they started the other regime change moves in the Middle East and such. And particularly in the last days of Hugo Chavez and then, you know, in the period subsequent. And so, you know, by this presidential election, you would have thought that they'd have their ducks all in a line. But going into the election period, again, you end up with Lopez on the one hand and Capriles on the other. You know, they're splitting the vote, and one of them is deciding they're going to boycott the election. And, you know, you ended up with a situation where it wasn't even close.
Right.
You have two opposition candidates that are running. One of them has twice as many votes as the other, and combined they have less than half as much as Maduro does. And
right.
And the landscape itself under natural conditions there is much closer. You know, we've seen in the various elections, even though the Socialist Party wins almost all of the elections, it's close. You've got like a 55-45 split, more or less, in the electorate.
Right.
You know, as a legacy of the history, you know, the class history of the country.
Right.
And this instead was something much, much different and much weaker at the end of the day. And it's simply being a consequence of their incompetence and their inability to play nice with each other. So. Right. We've got about a minute left, so maybe we could talk about.
Yeah, I think you're right to point that out, and that's another example of the internal weakness of U.S. allies in the region. But then, allied with that now, along with all the other strands making up the U.S. policy failure in the region, you now have China and the Russian Federation making very clear that they will resist insofar as they can, and that has to be taken very seriously,
right,
any attempt at a military intervention. And you have Mexico saying that it, you know, the second most important country in the region, that it firmly rejects any attempt at a military intervention.
Yep. And honestly, even those countries that are joining, you know, like this so-called Peru group or the Lima group, whatever, those that are joining, you know, affirmatively on votes here and there can't get too far out ahead of their own populations, or they're going to have to deal with it themselves. All right, we're going to come back to this and cover whatever else has happened in the intervening period next week. And I really appreciate your time, as always, Don.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to it.
Me too. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.